So, my Dhamma talk tonight will be on the three marks of existence, which are anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca is impermanence, dukkha is unsatisfactoriness or suffering, and anatta is not self. And I find that the contemplation of the three marks of existence ties in particularly well with observing mental states, observing thoughts and emotions. The Buddha defined the three marks as applying to everything that's within conditioned reality. So that's anything that exists within chains of cause and effect. So pretty much anything you can think of came from causes and also comes with its own effects. So anything in conditioned reality has these characteristics of being impermanent, of being unsatisfactory, and of being not self. And I find these to be, much like the rest of the Buddhist teachings, to be something that we know analytically. We know it just cerebrally, but it's not something that we can always observe as underlying our actions and our ways of relating to the world. And so I've been thinking recently about how our actions are often as if permanence was a thing, as if satisfying or satisfaction and idealism were a thing possible, and as if we had permanent, everlasting selves. So it can be a very helpful practice to take moments of our days, moments of our thoughts and our emotions and our actions, and to really examine underneath them and see if there are these underlying assumptions. So maybe we know that things are impermanent and unsatisfactory and not self, but we might be acting as if that were not the case. The Buddha ties in all three of these characteristics well. So the five aggregates monks are anicca, impermanent. Whatever is impermanent, that is dukkha, unsatisfactory. Whatever is dukkha, that is without atta, self. Whatever is without self, that is not mine, that I am not, that is not myself. Thus should it be seen by perfect wisdom as it really is. And the five aggregates, they are material, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And those are, the way that I understand them, and I'm still just learning these things, is that those are what we kind of keep our understandings of reality onto. It's what we identify as self, and it's what we identify as permanent and potentially satisfying, potentially ideal. And so you can see the ways that the three marks of existence are kind of interwoven into everything in our day-to-day lives, everything in our inner worlds and everything in our outer worlds. And so yeah, diligently practicing with the three marks can help us shift away from behavior that breeds more and more suffering. So when we think that we can hold on to things, when we think that relationships will stay the same, when we think that our lives will stay the same, when we identify with different aspects of life, we tend to be disappointed. We tend to set ourselves up for disappointment. And sometimes quite deeply so. And it also, I was reflecting on the fact that it makes total sense that we grasp after these things. We seek a sense of safety. We seek a sense of being able to understand the world. And we want to have that ability to know what's coming. We want certainty. And it's unfortunate that our attempts to protect ourselves from suffering end up setting us up for more suffering. And so, Ajahn Chah puts it as the practice of impermanence is really the practice of being with uncertainty. I was listening to a talk by Ajahn Amaro, where it was just a litany of I don't know. And so how to have that in every moment of every day, to just sit with the I don't know. And it was some very simple things that you would never think to question. It was something like walking through the doorway, will I be in the next room over? Don't know. Things you would never think to question. And it's kind of the ultimate beginner's mind if you've done any practice with that. And just being comfortable with uncertainty in general, with the I don't know, is a great way to practice with impermanence and be ready for the bigger impermanences that can come along and just bowl us over. Another quote from one of the suttas: impermanent are all component things. They arise and cease, that is their nature. They come into being and pass away. Release from them is bliss supreme. It's something that we can also know very deeply through simple observation. When we sit still on the cushion, we can notice that we are never not in motion. Our very breath, one of our main anchors, constantly in motion. Breathing in air, the body takes in oxygen through the lungs, distributes it through the body, through the pulse, through the bloodstream. I know that when I'm meditating, I can feel my body shifting, micro shifts, left to right, front to back. And then, as my attention wanders, slowly slumping usually. And so, by observing the fact that this universe within and without us is constantly in motion, it's another way to come into knowing impermanence and ever-changingness. There was another quote I found. It didn't have an author, but it was trying to seek safety in these false ideas of permanence is like building a house out of sand. It's destined to crumble. And I know that for me recently, as much as I have done practice with impermanence and change, I've been having a lot of grief over changing relationships. There are thoughts and views that have come to mind that have kind of changed the way that I see some very important people in my life. Changing values, changing motivations. And there are things that I realized that I was trying to kind of undo and trying to hold on to the relationship the way that it was, the way that it used to be. And so recognizing, I did spend some time at least honoring the motivations behind that, of knowing like, okay, this is because I value this relationship and it's because I value this person. And those motivations are not going to be well served by trying to deny reality, by trying to make things other than as they truly are. And so that's enabled me to do some practice with some flowing, and I also was able to then voice those experiences to the people involved. And we were able together to kind of renew and make a new relationship out of the one that we used to have. And if I hadn't done the practice of really looking at things as they truly are, we might not have never have had that. It might have just crumbled till it was no longer, or we might have continued to try and like force things to try and be the way that they used to be. Maybe that would have ended up with just like a complete break of the relationship. I don't know. But I'm very grateful for the practice and what it enabled me to do with that. And that kind of, as they all kind of trail into one another, I was thinking about it earlier, and as the three marks not being even like so much a Venn diagram, because if you did a Venn diagram, it'd basically just be one circle. It's all the same thing. But that brings us more over into dukkha, into unsatisfactoriness, which we do a lot of practice of because it's the first noble truth, right? That there is dukkha, that life is unsatisfying, that it involves suffering. And so that's just more of this idea that we have concepts in our heads of how things should be, And very rarely, unless we're really closely observing and closely like in the moment, will our mental ideas of things ever really match reality. And so just having that acceptance, doing the acceptance practice of the world will be other than as I expect it to be. The world will be other than as I want it to be. And how are my actions pointed as if the world could be as I want it to be? You know, how am I behaving in ways that really sort of expose this belief that we can achieve or can like grasp onto these ideals? So very important and very powerful to practice with that. And again, bringing it back to like the cushion practice that we just did and that we've been doing all today, just this idea that if we can watch the way that our minds and emotions flow, that our thoughts and emotions flow, we can start to excavate the hidden expectations underneath. I really appreciate the way Vinny Ferraro puts it. He says, what expectations are sponsoring this suffering? And I've taken that and expanded it a little bit for myself and saying, what hidden expectations are sponsoring the suffering? Because it really, I've really noticed that like if I do a quick look for expectations, I don't see much, probably because I don't want to. But then if I really am looking and feeling for the hidden expectations and the hidden motivations underneath things, that's when I can start to say, okay, here are some things that I didn't want to look at, that I chose not to look at. And then looking at them, taking breaks when I need to, because it can be hard and bring up a lot of grief in its own right, then being able to practice more acceptance and weave that into a new view of reality that's, I think, a little bit more truthful, and hopefully ultimately a lot more truthful as I go along. And then there's the concept of anatta, of not self. And this is a tricky one, especially Bob and I were talking earlier about it being particularly tricky for us Westerners. We have so much identity built up into every moment of our lives. And, you know, from birth till now, how many different identities have we held? You know, from identifying as a student, to identifying as a social worker, to identifying even as, you know, a family member or a significant other. And we grasp after those identities because they mean so much to us. And I think, again, it points to our driving need for safety and stability, for the world to be understandable and graspable. And it's unfortunate that our grasping after identity often leads to more suffering rather than less. Something you can think of as a short-term gain, but usually long-term suffering. In a day long that I attended here recently, we did a partnered exercise where we sat with somebody and for 7 minutes asked each other, who are you and what are you? 7 minutes and of that inquiry. And it was really interesting because it was kind of fairly far along in the day long that this happened. And I noticed that I, because of practice, I didn't have many labels coming up. I could hear other partner, other people in the day long saying, you know, I'm a sister, I am a father, I am a musician, I am, playwrights, and just these interesting labels and categories. And then when my partner was asking me, all I could come up with was like, I am a being who is inquiring. And I know that if we had done that exercise at the beginning of the day long, I would have just been a litany of labels also. Because that's ultimately how we see ourselves. Not ultimately, that's typically how we see ourselves. And then with practice, with some time looking within and examining reality around us, I think that kind of breaks those boxes open. And not that they don't have their uses. You know, language is kind of a shortcut of idea communication. We use it internally for shortcuts, and we use it externally to be understood by one another. So it's not like we need to do away with it entirely, I think, but rather to be able to use it more wisely and more realistically. I really appreciate this quote by Alan Watts, which is, "You are under no obligation to be the same person you were 5 minutes ago." I find that hugely liberating. And not only do we end up kind of causing ourselves suffering by, I constantly am finding myself holding myself accountable to these ideas of who and how I think I am. You know, sometimes it's things like telling a white lie and coming out of it being like, I'm not that kind of person. You know, I'm not the type of person to lie just because I'm uncomfortable. Like, but I did that. So that's a place where identity and concepts of identity can block our ability to see ourselves and our behavior realistically. And then, you know, I can then take that moment and say, I'm somebody who gets really uncomfortable by social confrontation or by perceiving that I'm going to cause other people discomfort. And sometimes I do unskillful things trying to avoid causing other people discomfort. And so we can take our typical identity stories, pause, be with it, and expand it out so that we can see all the different pieces that come within it. And another thing with identity is that we often hold each other accountable for what we think that the other person should be. I've noticed that I've been on both sides of that dynamic. So I've noticed a lot of suffering in myself trying to fight against what other people think I am or how they think I am. So people will say things like recently I've been taking a lot more time to be in solitude, to do more practice, and it's just felt natural. And I've had people say like, well, you're not somebody who would turn down these social invitations. You know, what's wrong? Are you depressed? I'm like, thank you for caring. And also it's actually because I've had these changes in my like motivations and my values. And it's very hard to explain when you're trying to hold me accountable to who you think I am and these behavior patterns that you see me as having had, and maybe I did have, but still, it's just really interesting to watch the ways in which that kind of expectation can lay the groundwork for more and more suffering at times. And, you know, a lot of people will have a pushback against the concepts and the practices of non-self, of non-identifying, because the questions can come up that can be really uncomfortable, such as, who am I if I'm not my story? Who am I if I'm not this identity? And, you know, it's interesting, as I feel like the place that's helped me or the practice that's really helped me with that is coming back to that impermanence. So this is another place where the marks can tie in together and help support each other. So practicing with impermanence and practicing with dukkha, acceptance thereof, can help you have the skills and the fortitude to then practice with concepts of not self. Because you can say, don't know. You know, bringing it back to the I don't know and being okay with it. That definitely can take some time, and it's perfectly natural to be uncomfortable in the meantime. Another practice that's really helpful with that is the practice of being more okay with being uncomfortable. So doing some body practice of noticing what it's like when I'm anxious, noticing how that shows up in the body, noticing how it shows up in the mind. Realizing that I can breathe through it, and that too is impermanent. Our discomfort arises and passes away as well. And so impermanence is one thing that you can neutralize a bit. It's not always a bad thing, because the uncomfortable things, the not so good things, are impermanent as well as the good things are. And that's something interesting too that I noticed in my own practice, was how much I questioned the good things because they were impermanent. So not letting myself really be in the joyous moments, not really be able to like be with even like a sunset or a beautiful flower let alone having like a good, you know, solid connection of intimacy moment with somebody. So just constantly questioning my investment and my buy-in to these moments that are destined to pass away. And instead of valuing them for being impermanent and valuing them for the, you know, joy that they held or the richness that they held, instead I would hold myself at arm's length from these things because I didn't want to experience the discomfort of their passing away. And so that's something to consider, is how much do we hold ourselves closed? How much do we hold ourselves at a distance from things for the sake of trying to avoid suffering? And then how much are our safety mechanisms, or our coping mechanisms, really building more suffering? And if we can recognize that, we can find new ways to weave new behavior patterns. So starting with just like the recognition, starting with the seeing things more truly as they are. And so as we take this practice of observing mind states, we might also apply looking for the three marks as we do our cushion practice, or as we do our in the streets practice. Noticing for moments where we're acting as if things are permanent, looking for moments where we're acting as if things could be ideal, and noticing for moments when we have identity grasping, you know, when we're grasping after identity, and seeing if we can just maybe have a little bit more relaxation in those moments. You know, if we want to use our anchor to take a break and then observe what's going on from a more neutral, not so caught up perspective. And also looking for what the opposing view might be. So if you were truly feeling impermanence, and if you were truly feeling the truth of dukkha, and if you were truly feeling the transience of identity, what might that do to that reaction, to that relationship to existence that you're experiencing in that moment? So these are some calls to waking up, some calls to reality. And I wanted to invite you guys to, I guess, maybe spend the evening practicing on this. So just tonight, you know, after we part ways here, after we head home, to see when you have those grasping after permanence and satisfactoriness and identity. See if you can notice when they arise, and see if you can have a little bit of observation and noticing of how that plays out. I had an example of how that might look because I was doing this on my own drive home last night. So I think I'll end my Dhamma talk with that sharing. So as I was driving home last night, I was trying to set an intention to go to bed early because I wanted to be well rested, get up early, start fresh, and honestly prepare for this Dhamma talk and this facilitation that I'm doing leading. Because I didn't have too much time between knowing I was going to do this and doing it. And on my 30-minute drive home, because I live up in Boulder Creek, a lot can change. So as I got home, I had a lot of energy, like a lot of energy in my mind and my body. So I was just noticing that I have just this like buzzing energy going on, and it's not a conducive state in which to go to sleep immediately. And so I was faced with a choice to either try and force myself to be in the state that I wanted to be in and the intention that I had set myself in, or I could use the energy and maybe do some prep work, or I could, out of like, and this is what I would have done most of the time before I started practicing, get so frustrated by the fact that I was not in the state I intended to be in, mm-hmm. that I wouldn't do anything useful, and I'd go on YouTube and be up for like 6 hours on YouTube doing nothing. That was old habits, and they still come up sometimes. I am happy to report that I did kind of a happy medium of doing some reading and doing a little note-taking. And then I also was able to do some body practice because I've noticed that that's something I can do to shift myself into a calmer state. It's like I kind of carry exhaustion around with me all the time, so I just need to be able to tap into that to go to sleep. It's not difficult. Yeah. And I also noticed, stories coming up about identity, that had identity pieces to them, of because I've always had a very troubled relationship with sleep. And so I had this like story come up of I'm an insomniac. I can't, I can never sleep when I want to. I feel like I always have to like reverse psychology myself into sleep. It's like I try to stay awake and that'll make me sleep, or I try to sleep and that'll make me wake up. So it just feels like my mind is constantly like a very like obtuse child doing the opposite of what I want it to do. So just noticing those identity stories of like who I am and how I am, and also recognizing that when I get caught up in those cause suffering. So I was able to like watch that come up, laugh at it because that's really helpful, and then kind of go back into the moment and be with what really was. And not so much that story of like, maybe that is true, maybe there's a pattern, but also it's not really useful in this moment for me to continue telling myself that story. And so I was able to flow with my evening, and I felt like it was very fruitful and very good. So not that your evening will play out anything like that, but those are just some examples of how you might take this observation practice with you after we end our day here today. And with that, we have come to our 8 o'clock mark. So now it's time for walking meditation practice, or the practice discussion, if you want to join that. So I guess I would invite you guys, as you're doing your walking meditation, maybe watch how mind states arise. So, using your anchor of your breath, of the body, how it feels to walk. To place one foot in front of the other. And then also notice, as you have been probably all along, just how mind states can come up, how they can grip us, carry us away from what we're doing, and then see if you can bring it back to the physical activity of walking or watching your breath.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.